evening. The FBI says they were not behind a coup against the president. Sports and politics in the age of Trump and the possibility of war with Iran. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, May 10th, 2019. Former top FBI lawyer James Baker offered a robust defense Friday of the Bureau's investigation into President Trump and his 2016 campaign. Baker took aim at Trump's allegation the inquiry was an FBI coup. He says he sought to ensure agents' work was on solid legal footing. The comments came at a taping of the Lawfare podcast with editor-in-chief Ben Wittes of the Brookings Institution. It was Baker's first public remarks on the investigation, eventually to be taken over by special counsel Robert Mueller.
The president says it was a coup, right? It was an attempted coup. If there was an attempted coup, you're counselor to the coup, right? You're the sort of legal counsel to the coup plotters. Is now Jim Comey has been fired, and the New York Times has reported, and Bob Mueller has now validated that reporting that an obstruction investigation was opened at that point. The New York Times has said it had a counterintelligence investigation. I don't think that specifically has been confirmed, but you were asked about it in your deposition to the House last year, and they have released the transcript of that, and your answers were allowed by the Bureau. So with that as caveat, you guys seem to have opened at least one, sort of two investigations or concurrent investigations involving the president at that point. The president talks about this as a coup. How comfortable are you with the predication of those investigations, with what you guys did, and with the way you did it?
Okay, that's a lot to unpack. There was no attempted coup.
No coup? No. Not even no. A little coup?
There was no coup. There was no attempted coup. There was no conspiracy to commit a coup. There was nothing having to do with a coup.
Was the word coup ever spoken?
Not to my recollection in that time frame, no. I don't know how else to say it. And had anybody even proposed such a thing, or said such a thing, or mentioned such a thing, I can tell you that I would not have tolerated it whatsoever. I have gone to the mat in the past in my career with stuff that I thought was inappropriate, and I would have called out such a thing, and I either would have stopped it immediately or resigned or reported it to the IG or reported it to Congress or done some other action to make sure that it was dealt with. There was no way in hell that I was going to allow some coup or coup attempt to take place on my watch, or any conspiracy to do anything unlawful. No way.
The Justice Department Inspector General is investigating the handling of various aspects of the Russia case. Attorney General William B. Barr recently alleged government spying occurred on the Trump campaign. While Barr has insisted he didn't mean to imply wrongdoing, critics note that his language mirrors the president's attacks on the Bureau and its investigation. Baker was the FBI's general counsel when the Russia probe was initiated, and when Mueller took over, he was reassigned from the top legal post in December 2017 after he got caught up in the FBI leak probe, and he confirmed Friday that case is ongoing. The world champion Boston Red Sox baseball team got a tour of the White House with President Donald Trump on Thursday. At least all the white players and one player of color did. At least 10 more players, all Latino or African American, in the team that bested the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Dodgers, opted to be somewhere else. Trump is an avid baseball fan who bragged about playing the sport in high school, but even the self-promoting commander-in-chief had to admit his skills were at a different level than the championship players who surrounded him on the White House lawn. Sports has been the place of solace for past presidents facing criticism in their jobs, turning to honoring sports heroes. Trump was no different as he lauded his $718.3 billion defense budget.
To all of the coaches and players of the Red Sox, congratulations on your incredible victory. The team has just come from the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, where they visited our wounded heroes and wounded warriors. And they believe very strongly in that. I want to thank the entire Red Sox organization for your longstanding support for those American service members who have suffered the wounds of war to keep our country safe and strong and free. And we've never had a stronger military right now. This is the strongest it's been. $716 billion we spent last year. John, that's a lot of money even for you, right? Did you say? That's a lot of money. Over the course of the 2018 season, the Red Sox were, frankly, they were unstoppable. I watched. You outscored your opponents by 229 runs and won 108 games in the regular season. The most in Red Sox history. You got a lot of fans over here.
Got a lot of fans, huh?
Despite Trump's familiarity with baseball and expressed love for the Red Sox, the White House had originally and incorrectly labeled the team Red Sox, spelled S-O-C-K-S, and not the correct S-O-X on its website. But Trump kept to the script. Red Sox designated hitter J.D. Martinez presented Trump with Red Sox jersey number 18 to signify the Red Sox winning the 2018 World Series. Majority owner John Henry, who has donated over $1 million to the Democratic Party, was with the team too. But David Price, Xander Bogaerts, Sandy Leon, Eduardo Nunez, Hector Velasquez, Jackie Bradley Jr., Rafael Devers, and MVP Mookie Betts all declined to attend the ceremony. Outspoken pitcher David Price retweeted a joke about the White Sox showing up, highlighting that most of the team's players of color, had stayed home. Price told the Boston Globe the post was an insensitive tweet that needs to be seen by more people. The team's manager, Alex Cora, was also absent. He hails from Puerto Rico and explains his position on a sports talk show.
When you go into the country, you go to the mountains, you know, there's this little town, actually. It's called Utuado. And right now, you know, most of them, they don't have electricity. You know, it's very hard to get to that place. You know, it's in the mountains. And there's a lot of places like that back home. And for me, obviously, you know, just being around the island and knowing what is going on and how people are, you know, it doesn't feel right, you know. And I made sure, and I've been saying it all along, I said it last year, and I said it this year, the government has helped, but we still have long ways to go. And I put it in capital letters. This is our reality. You know, I'm the guy that has lived it. I'm the guy down there, you know, in the off season. I understand how it is, you know, and I just don't feel right going and celebrate while people are struggling back home.
Cora is the first coach or manager not accompanying players to the White House following a championship. Individual members of teams have opted out, and teams like the Golden State Warriors have been uninvited by Trump when they threatened not to attend. Reports of a racial divide among the players were answered by team chair Tom Werner, who told reporters in the White House driveway the meeting with Trump had been apolitical.
We don't see it as a racial divide. We've been pleased to come to the White House. This is our fourth visit here. It was not a mandatory invitation. Those people who wanted to come were invited to join. And I think to the extent that we can, we think that baseball's apolitical. And today is neither a red day or a blue day. It's a great day for us to be honored at the White House, and we're very appreciative.
Tom, do you understand that why many players chose not to come today, and do you see it as any issue going forward with your team?
Well, not at all. I think that Chris Sale has said that this is something that is not going to divide the clubhouse, and those people who wanted to come were appreciative of the invitation, and we were going to play another game tomorrow night.
Have you talked to the players who didn't come about their decision and their thinking?
Yeah, I've talked to Alex about it, the manager, and I certainly understand his decision not to come. And I respected it.
Did the president bring that up in his conversations inside the residence?
No, he didn't.
Did you ever consider it optional as a team for anybody to come? Are you disappointed at all that a lot of players didn't come and a lot of personnel decided not to come?
No, I think this was something that each player decided on his own whether or not to come. And we decided as owners that today would be an apolitical day. And so we were very happy to be here. It's really, as you all know, this is one of the great places in the world, one of the great museums, and to walk into these rooms and to be in the Lincoln bedroom. I've never been in the Lincoln bedroom before. It was a thrill.
Tom Werner is chair of the Boston Red Sox organization. He spoke at the White House. Earlier this week, National Security Advisor John Bolton announced the U.S. is deploying a carrier strike group and a bomber task force to the U.S. Central Command region covering the Persian Gulf and Iran. Bolton declared the United States is not seeking war with Iran, but he added, "We are fully prepared to respond to any attack, whether by proxy, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or regular Iranian forces." The fact that Bolton chose to repurpose routine deployments of U.S. military forces into the Middle East as an emergency response to an unspecified threat from Iran has had geopolitical experts talking. One of those is former nuclear weapons proliferation inspector and former Marine Scott Ritter. He says the U.S. may be boxing itself into a corner where the only exit is war. And first, we're going to hear from the Secretary of Defense.
It's important that Iran understand that an attack on Americans or its interests will be met with an appropriate response. We're in the Middle East to defeat terrorism, fight, and build security. The clandestine insurgencies are really what we're there to address. But we will protect ourselves, and that's very important. I won't really address what the Iranians are doing. I just want to talk about what the Americans are doing. We will position ourselves. We will protect our interests. But we're there to build security. We're there to address violent extremism, and that's our focus.
And now to Scott Ritter, a former Marine Corps intelligence officer.
I believe that the United States policy under President Trump is to place Iran under what the administration is calling maximum pressure, so that it will force or compel Iran to renegotiate the Iranian nuclear deal on terms that are acceptable to the Trump administration, namely speaking, Iran's surrender when it comes to its right to enrich uranium. I don't believe that the Trump administration as a collective is seeking military conflict. In fact, President Trump ran on a platform which was based on the premise that we would get out of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and avoid entering into similar type conflicts. But, you know, Trump has a tendency to press hard across the spectrum of policy options. So, you know, we saw that with North Korea when he talked about fire and fury and threatened war, nuclear war, to get North Korea to come to, you know, to enter into negotiations. And we see this today. We see, you know, the tightening of economic sanctions, which are very harmful to Iran. And we see the rhetoric of Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, which is a very warlike rhetoric. This doesn't mean that the president wants war. It just means that he's placing pressure on Iran to try and get behavioral adjustments. The danger in this is if Iran refuses to play the game. And the United States ends up boxing itself into a corner policy-wise where the only option available is war. And I think that's the direction we're heading. It's not because Trump wants a war. It's because the rhetoric of his policy advisors on national security are getting him boxed in.
You're familiar with this country. What would it mean, a war with Iran? Would it be a cakewalk in the beginning, or would it be a difficult fight?
Well, let's keep in mind that unlike Iraq in 2003, Iran is not a defeated nation. Iran didn't lose a war like Iraq did in 1991. Iran didn't have its military destroyed. Iran wasn't subjected to crippling sanctions that prohibited or prevented its military from rebuilding. You know, the Iraq war in 2003 is a very deceptive event. First of all, it wasn't a cakewalk, although we won handily. I think it's given people who are unfamiliar with war a false notion, a misguided notion that you know, the United States military is invincible and cannot be defeated. Understand one thing, that a war with Iran is lost if we fail to win it. It's not lost if we lose it. It's lost if we fail to win it. And what I mean by that is, take, for example, Israel's conflict with Hezbollah in 2006. You can't say that Hezbollah won that war, but Hezbollah did win that war because Israel did not win that war. Israel entered that conflict believing that it would destroy Hezbollah, eliminate Hezbollah, wipe Hezbollah off the map, so to speak. And at the end of the war, they fought to a standstill where Hezbollah not only continued to hold territory, but on certain areas actually pushed the Israelis back. So it was a fantastic psychological victory, a political victory for Hezbollah, because simply by surviving, they win. And this is all Iran has to do. When we speak of a war between Iran and the United States, understand that the United States simply does not have the conventional military capacity to defeat Iran on the field of battle. That doesn't mean that Iran is going to win. It just means that we cannot achieve the kind of objectives that would be required for us to, for instance, terminate the regime. We will not be occupying Tehran. We will not be occupying any territory in the country of Iran. We don't have the military capacity to do that. We will not be dominating Iranian airspace across the full spectrum. We might be able to achieve, you know, certain temporary supremacy over a given target so that we can bomb it successfully. But the Iranians have a you know, very viable air defense network, which is going to cause us problems. It's a large country. We can't surge the number of aircraft required over a sustained period of time to have any meaningful military impact. We'll be able to have pretty pictures of cruise missiles taking off from ships, you know, and maybe have some video images of missiles impacting sites. But as we saw with the strike against Syria, we end up bombing a lot of empty buildings, a lot of buildings that intelligence got wrong. I think that we're making a very big mistake if we think that a conflict with Iran is going to be a cakewalk. First of all, Iran has the ability to strike back, not only at anybody attacking them in self-defense, but also to launch counterattacks of their own using a very capable ballistic missile capability that can strike American military bases in the region. If we attack Iran, our forces in Syria, our forces in Iraq, our forces in Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia will all come under immediate attack. And the Iranian missiles are quite accurate, and they have a lot of them, and they are designed to defeat the American anti-missile capabilities. So some of these missiles will indeed impact their intended targets, causing significant casualties. They also have the ability to sink American ships in the Persian Gulf. So we need to be careful about, you know, jumping off, embarking on a course of action that we're not prepared to see through. I think this is one of the reasons why the Pentagon had their meeting yesterday with Mike Pompeo and the other senior national security advisors, where they laid out the reality of military conflict with Iran. I think the Pentagon was trying to put a marker down on the table, telling Trump and his bellicose advisors that there will be a cost, you know, a price to be paid if we take out Iran, not only militarily, but economically. They will shut down the Strait of Hormuz, a strategic waterway where a significant portion of the world's oil transits on a daily basis. If that gets shut down for a day, a week, a month, the global economy will take a you know, horrific hit. So, you know, war with Iran is a completely different kettle of fish, and I don't think too many people who are thumping their chests today, bragging about how great the American military is, understands what we'll be getting into.
Have you ever been to Iran?
I have.
And what is your estimation of the Iranian government and people? Are they steadfast, or are they weak? Could they be knocked over? What do you think?
Well, the first thing we have to understand is that the Iranian government, again, in the United States, we tend to demonize things, to oversimplify things, and we call it a theocracy. This is absolutely wrong. Iran today is a religious democracy. It's a very viable democracy. The theocratic element of the government, the mullahs, the ayatollahs, they derive their ability to govern based upon the support of the people. This is an inherent design of the Islamic Republic from the very beginning. This is why on every election, the Iranian government pushes for maximum participation. And unlike the United States, where we're lucky to get, 54% of the eligible electorate out, the Iranians consider 72% participation a failure. If only 72% of the population participates in an election, that means that the people are not satisfied with the government, and that bodes ill for the government. Right now, we have a situation where Iran is a thriving democracy. The people participate in the election. They elect their representatives. Their representatives give them a functioning parliament that has a say in the way that the government, the nation is governed. It has a president that has real political power. And, of course, it has a supreme leader that ensures that what the legislative and executive bodies do conform with the precepts of Islam. So it's a very resilient government. It's not going away anytime soon. Anybody who thinks that by tightening sanctions there will be revolts in the streets and the government will be tossed out have no clue about the history of Iran, the history of the Iranian Revolution, and the history of what has transpired from 1979 until today. The Iranian government is not perfect. They make a lot of mistakes. They'll be the first to admit it. But it is a government of the people, by the people, for the people, in a way that many other so-called democracies in the region are not.
The possibility of small wars and unexpectedly becoming large wars.
I don't think there's going to be secret treaties with Iran and, for instance, Russia, Iran, and China that's going to create a global war. Iran doesn't need that. Iran doesn't want that. But, we have, for instance, recently designated the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command as a terrorist organization. What we've done, therefore, that's the equivalent of declaring that the National Guard of the United States Army is a terrorist organization. I'm not saying that there's a moral equivalency between the two. What I'm saying is that we're talking about armed forces of a government, and we now have called them terrorists. And that's put us on a collision course. For instance, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command controls the Strait of Hormuz. Every U.S. naval vessel that transits has to communicate with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and announce their presence and what their intention is. That means that on a daily basis, we're communicating with terrorists. That's the stupidity of this policy. It also puts us in a situation where if Iran tries to sell oil using a ship that is registered under with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command, we can intercept that ship and seize the oil. This is the kind of thing that can lead to a so-called limited conflict that can quickly spin out of control. And when I say out of control, understand that a war with Iran will not be limited to Iran only. It will engulf the entire Middle East, and if the Iranians are as clever as they think they are, it will involve Europe, maybe South America, and other areas as well. So, yeah, it's not like World War One, where we have this intricate web of treaties, but it's a modern manifestation of that, where we don't understand whom we are dealing with and what the ramifications of our policies will be. We have a bunch of amateurs in the White House who are doing things that play well with the American public, without due regard for what the reality is on the ground in the Middle East.
Great. And last thing, do you see any way out of this?
The key is Europe, and Europe is very disappointed at this point. The most important thing for Iran right now is to be able to sell its oil. And Europe is the key to that. Europe is supposed to be setting up these special financial vehicles that allow for trade outside of the U.S.-dominated banking system, thereby bypassing American sanctions. But the Europeans have been dragging their feet. The Iranians have given them 60 days to get their act together. I'm very concerned that the Europeans are not going to be able to meet that window, And if that occurs, Iran will start enriching uranium to 20% as it's threatened to do. And this could lead to a cascade of events that culminate in a U.S. military strike against Iran. So I'm not very optimistic right now.
Scott Ritter is a former Marine Corps intelligence officer who served in the former Soviet Union implementing arms control treaties in the Persian Gulf during Operation Desert Storm and in Iraq overseeing the disarmament of weapons of mass destruction. And finally, Thursday was Victory Day in Russia, the day 74 years ago the Soviet Union cemented its defeat of Nazi Germany. The Nazi war machine failed to take Moscow and reach their high water mark at Stalingrad. In thousands of grueling battles, the unknown war saw at least 50 million dead, an entire generation of young men. It ended with Soviet occupation of Berlin, the German capital, and the hoisting of the red flag over the Reichstag capital. And that's some of the news for Friday, May 10th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining your listener-sponsored community radio station. Please take a moment to become a WBAI buddy by calling 516-620-3602. Have a great weekend.